Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden, joined by tonight's co-host, retired San Francisco attorney David Begeleisen, with tonight's broadcast devoted to elder abuse. Some practices are obvious, such as physical abuse or neglect, or falsifying financial records or forging signatures. Others may be more subtle, such as selling a senior on a poor investment with huge commissions, or selling unneeded repairs to their home. Stick around and learn a bit about protecting seniors from a whole litany of scams and predatory practices.
Tonight we'll be talking about the various different issues of elder abuse, including physical abuse and financial abuse. Who is eligible to make a claim for elder abuse, and what should the family members do when they see something coming up? Our guest tonight is Karma Gadani, and you'll hear a little bit more about her in a minute or two.
Are there precautions we can take to avoid, whether it's neglect or abuse, whatever it may be, are there precautions we can take? Well, for starters, give us a call. Our phone number right here is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. Tonight we're talking about elder abuse. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. Bear in mind that our attorney guests cannot provide you precise legal advice without all the facts relating to a given case. However, we're happy to pass along legal principles, assist in your decision-making, and while their legal guidance mightn't be the positions of their employers or their clients, they're here to help. And with that, David, who do we have here tonight with us?
Our guest today is Karma Gadani, an esteemed elder abuse lawyer. She's the managing partner of the law firm of Stebner, Gertner, and Gadani, and they are the leaders throughout California in the area of elder abuse. She's the author of a portion of one of the Bibles that lawyers refer to in the area of elder abuse, published by Continuing Education of the Bar. She is a graduate of University of California Law School in San Francisco, previously known as Hastings, and among other things, she teaches to lawyers through the San Francisco Trial Lawyers Association, and she teaches part-time at Stanford Law School. Carmen, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, David and Jeff. I'm really happy to be here.
And Carmen, before we get started in earnest, before we get too deep in the weeds, I want to begin by asking your expert opinion. What are some of the red flags family members should be looking for? I mean, how do we distinguish neglect from normal aging? And I know these are things that exist both someone being at home or in assisted living. What are some of the red flags that give us an idea something's wrong?
I feel like in this time, Jeff, family members really need to be on the lookout for lots of different red flags, things that can really go under the radar. So when an elder is at home or in a long-term care facility, there are certain things that people can sort of brush off as a part of normal aging, things like bed sores or falls or changes in behavior, where on further inspection with more investigation or a little bit of deep dive, you can find out are actually related to neglect or a lack of proper care. And I think the other thing, which I know we plan to talk about a little bit later, that people really need to be looking out for is financial abuse and how to be aware and prepare for scams that are prevalently targeting the elders in our society right now.
Carmen, let me begin by first asking you about some of your work, and that is you specialize in civil elder abuse cases. Would you take just a minute and distinguish between the civil work that you do and criminal elder abuse?
Sure, David. So civil elder abuse cases come under the authority of the Elder Abuse Act, which was passed in 1991 by the California legislature to give civil remedies to people who are the victims of elder abuse, whether it's financial abuse, physical abuse, or neglect. What they can get is compensation to try to make them whole after they've been injured in some way under the Civil Elder Abuse Act. And so the way that that differs from criminal elder abuse is if there's a violation of a criminal elder abuse statute or regulation or rule, then that person can be prosecuted and potentially face jail time or other penalties. Under a civil case, we're seeking compensation as a way to make the person whole or as close to whole as they can be after they've been harmed.
Carmen, who are the population that you serve, the people that fall within the category of elder abuse that you do?
Sure. So it's a little bit broader than it might seem initially. So the Elder Abuse Act is actually called the Elder and Dependent Adult Civil Protection Act, or EADACPA. And so elders under the statute are people over the age of 65, which is a huge percentage of California's population. According to the census, California has the most elderly residents across the nation. More than 800 million people fall into that category. 8 million people fall into that category. But also covered by the Elder Abuse Act are dependent adults. And a dependent adult is defined under the law as either someone who needs assistance with activities of daily living. So that's things like eating or drinking, moving positions, getting dressed. Not medical care necessarily, but the other basic activities that everyone does in order to get through their lives. That dependent adult section of the act also, though, applies to people who are inpatients in a medical care facility.
Now, there are two kinds of elder abuse that we can be talking about tonight. One is physical abuse, and the other is financial abuse. Would you like to start out with the physical abuse and tell our audience about that?
Sure, David. So there are a lot of different types of physical abuse. So the first category that I deal with most commonly in my job, in my practice, is cases where we're talking about neglect. And I think this is, again, something where the civil versus criminal definitions might be different. Under the law, neglect is defined in a lot of ways. It's actually pretty broad. So neglect can be the failure to provide hygiene, food, shelter, or clothing to an elder or a dependent adult. It can be the failure to provide medical care. It can be the failure to protect someone from health and safety hazards, or the failure to do something that a reasonable person in a position of a long-term care facility operator or an in-home caregiver should have done. So that's neglect, and there are lots of different injuries that can come out of that, and that sort of depends on the situation. And that's when I was talking earlier about having to be on the alert for things that might look like just part of aging. Neglect can lead to things like bed sores, falls, dehydration, malnutrition, or infections. And so a lot of the work in neglect cases that I do is against long-term care facilities, skilled nursing facilities, or assisted living, or also facilities that provide that type of assistance to dependent adults. But neglect can also occur by caregivers in the home or by relatives.
And now what are we talking about in that regard? Should we now move on to issues of physical abuse?
Sure.
Well,
so
before we do,
sure.
Talk a little bit more about the neglect. I mean, who are the potential defendants in cases like these? Who is it that we're watching out for?
Sure. So under the civil EDACPA, the act, the definition is broad, but one of the common factors is that you can only hold someone responsible for neglect civilly under the law if they have care and custody of the elder. So you could potentially have as a defendant a caregiver, a relative, someone who's responsible on a continuing basis for providing care and support and assistance. There are some cases that have come out that sort of have separated off people who just have intermittent contact. They might not be able to be defendants in a case of neglect. There might be another avenue for that. So we're most often looking at long-term care facilities, whether they're skilled nursing, assisted living. In California, there's sort of two categories of assisted living facilities. There are the larger assisted living facilities, which are often more expensive, and then there's smaller in-home board and care facilities. Those are the most common, I think, defendants in these cases. And generally, it's our practice to go after the providers, the operators of the facilities, as opposed to going after the caregivers themselves, the staff in the facilities that's providing the day-to-day care, who are often just kind of trying to do their job as best they can under whatever constraints they have.
Do these facilities have insurance to help to pay for this?
So that's a great question. And interestingly, there's not a legal requirement, for example, for skilled nursing facilities in California to have an insurance. Now, most good business people, most smart operators do, but there are times when there is no insurance. For assisted living or residential care facilities for the elderly, they are legally required to have insurance, but unfortunately, there has been sort of an under-the-radar epidemic of unlicensed facilities that take people in and agree to provide them care without a license. If you don't have a license, you don't have to get insurance, and so that can create a big problem there. But there is often coverage available for people who are seeking civil remedies in cases like this.
If there's no insurance, what can your firm do to help somebody under those circumstances?
Well, if there's no insurance, it can certainly create an opportunity to be creative, to figure out how you can help the person. And so what we may have to do is we may have to look at, you know, if there isn't a regular commercial general liability insurance policy, maybe is there an alternative way to get coverage through homeowners or some other kind of policy? If that's not available, then we look at the assets that may be available from the operator themselves to see if we can figure out something to help our clients get compensation and be made whole for their injuries.
When do you know as a family member that it's time to call in for an attorney to help or to call the police?
That's a great question, Jeff. And I think there's never probably a bright line rule, but I would say that if in both the physical and the financial abuse context, if you ever even have a suspicion or an inkling, I think it's worth reaching out to a trusted advisor, a family member, or an expert to talk it through and find out. The attorneys that practice in this area that represent victims of abuse don't charge hourly. So it's not like you have to pay the initial consultation fee or anything. People that do these cases really want to help protect the rights of elders and get them compensation when they've been injured. And so we're always, you know, my firm has a practice. We will take anyone's call. And if we can help you, we'll try to point you in the right direction. And there are also a lot of agencies or nonprofits that do this work that are good resources. In terms of when to call the police, if you feel like you've been the victim of a crime, you should call the police. And if you're not sure, you should probably call the police. We see a lot of, especially in cases of physical abuse, and cases of sexual abuse, which unfortunately sexual abuse against elders happens a lot more than you would think. Those cases are sometimes not reported because there's a fair amount of shame, I think, around the abuse. But it's important to call. And also in the case of financial abuse, as soon as someone has made a transaction that they find out was fraudulent or something like that, if there's a problem, the faster you contact your credit card company, your bank, the police, the more likely you are to be able to get your money back or stop the transaction.
Carmen, do physicians have an affirmative duty to report elder abuse when they observe it?
That's a great question, David. So actually, there's a set of laws, mandated reporter requirements, which require not only physicians, but healthcare providers, social workers, and a broad category of people, ambulance drivers, to report not only if they can confirm elder abuse or neglect, but also even if they just suspect it. And so there's an obligation to do that. I think, unfortunately, there's a lot of abuse and neglect that flies under the radar, but there is a heightened sense among healthcare providers, especially, to be on the lookout for things like wounds, signs of abuse, neglect or abandonment, and to report those things.
You've spoken a little bit about physical abuse. Do you want to elaborate on that a little bit further?
Sure. So both in the long-term care arena and also in people who are elders who are living at home or wherever they are, if, as with any population, there's an opportunity for physical abuse of the type you would expect, similar to child abuse, you know, hitting or restraining an elder, photographing or videotaping people without their consent. We've seen that, especially in the population with dementia. There have been some cases publicized where, you know, maybe someone caught it on a nanny cam or recorded things on their phone and shared them publicly. I think that kind of falls under that same physical abuse or privacy violation arena. And then, like I said, there's we see a significant number of rape and molestation cases at our office, particularly when the victim has dementia or some other form of cognitive impairment. And sexual abuse in long-term care happens a lot more than people would think. There was a study in 2017 where almost 1% of staff in skilled nursing reported that they had abused residents sexually, and 2% of residents in skilled nursing facilities in that same study felt that they had been the victim of some type of sexual abuse. And that sexual abuse is complicated, I think, in our society. Often people hesitate to talk about sexuality along with the elderly or to want to think about those things. And so, especially, for example, with elderly women with dementia, if sexualized behaviors start to become more pronounced or more common, people can shy away from that or not want to investigate it or take protections against it. But that's exactly the situation where those people can fall victim to someone that wants to abuse them.
Sometimes the people who are in nursing facilities who are suffering from sexual abuse also have mental health issues, as you've just observed. What techniques do you use in communicating with those clients in order to gather the information that you need in order to present their cases?
Evidence gathering in those cases can be really challenging. There's not always penetration or like a rape kit, which can confirm that a rape has happened. There's a lot of molestation or things like that that can happen. And so it's really about taking the words and actions of the elder, the family members, and the people that know that person seriously. And then looking for other physical signs, DNA, if there's video, anything. It's, you know, but it's really a lot more sleuthing out what happened than in a lot of other cases, because certainly those type of things are not going to be documented in the medical record. We know, though, that often people who will sexually abuse one person have a history or pattern of doing it to others. And so if we see something or if something's confirmed in a facility, that leads us usually to take a broader look at the care of other residents to see whether that's happened to other people.
Is that commonplace that you flush it out where it's not been reported? Maybe you have a line on somebody from a previous incident and you start finding other victims that perhaps aren't even aware?
We have had that happen, yeah. And actually, you know, I think as in any industry, people that want to find an opportunity to abuse someone will take whatever opportunity they can. We had a case in the past where a woman was going to a skilled nursing facility in California to do sort of pastoral services and meet with residents, and her boyfriend would go with her to the facility, and while she was having those meetings, he would go into the rooms of residents with dementia and touch them in unwanted sexual ways. So it does happen more than you think.
Are there more things that you want to share with us on the subject of physical abuse or neglect of elderly people before we go on to the financial abuse?
Just one other area which is not often appreciated is that under the regulations, under the laws, you can also have a cause of action for abandonment. And so what that is defined as is the desertion or willful forsaking of an elder or a dependent adult by someone that has care or custody of that person. And so an example of this that I could bring up is in the Santa Rosa tub fires in 2018. There was a long-term care facility, a memory care facility, with only residents who had a dementia diagnosis inside. And in that case, the staff didn't know what to do, didn't have training, couldn't get a hold of their management. And so without knowing an evacuation plan to get these residents out of the building, they left, leaving more than 40 elderly demented residents alone in this facility. Thankfully, those people were able to get out because some really brave family members came to their rescue. But the cause of action or the focus of that case was really that those people, the caregivers, and more than anything, the management had abandoned them there. But I think that kind of covers generally the broad categories of physical abuse and neglect.
Would that also include something like not providing nourishment or not changing dressings or diapers or things like that? Does that fall under abandonment?
I would say that more falls under the category of neglect. So neglect is really not meeting the physical needs. If you left someone totally behind, it probably gets into abandonment. But there is some crossover there.
What kind of records would you look at in order to substantiate your cases?
Well, it depends. So for a skilled nursing facility, the more high level of care, the more documentation there is. Every level of documentation, you know, we scrutinize the records as much as we can. But for example, for things like assisted living facilities, the regulations don't require a lot of documentation. And so sometimes a resident will have been living in a facility for 5 or 6 months and the entire medical record from that facility is only 50 pages. Whatever we can find to investigate and substantiate our claims, we will go through it top to bottom. The biggest thing, though, where we get evidence in our cases, often we start with the medical record, but then we need to talk to the staff in the facility and the management.
Are there obstacles that you face when you're talking with the staff?
There are obstacles. Like I said before, often the people that work in long-term care facilities as care providers are people who don't necessarily have a lot of other options for places to work. And they're people who probably are not on the top of the pay scale. And so a lot of times when we're speaking with people trying to figure out what happened in an abuse case, we're speaking with someone who's very fearful that if they're too candid, they may lose their job and their source of income, their livelihood. So that can be a challenge. And another challenge that we see often is the destruction of important documents or medical records or changing documentation after the fact.
Do the facilities sometimes interfere with your ability to interview the staff of these facilities?
They certainly prefer let me say it this way. So in a case against a long-term care facility, especially if there's insurance, the insurance will provide an attorney to the facility and to the facility staff. The facilities would certainly prefer that the staff that we are talking to are represented by their attorney so that they can speak to them first.
Okay. Any more on physical abuse?
I don't think so. I think that covers it for now.
Shall we talk about financial abuse?
Sure.
Maybe we hold off on that for a minute. We have about 2 minutes before we need to break for a station ID, and it would be a great transition move into financial abuse. The other thing I wanted to ask you, though, when it comes to physical abuse, what are things people can be doing to avoid it, to be forewarned?
That's a great question. So I think the biggest way that people can be proactive against physical abuse is to be involved and advocate for the elders' care, to be there and have your face known in a facility and have the staff know that you are watching and paying attention, and to really watch and check in with your relatives and believe them and follow up and ask questions. I think those are the biggest things you can do.
So, of course, being absentee would get in the way. And the more contact you have with the person, the more you're talking to them every day or as often as you can, the better the information is.
100%. And I think that also when the staff in a facility or a caregiver at home is constantly seeing the face of loved ones, they know that it's not just that someone's watching and someone's paying attention, and it sort of, I think, leads to a step up in the level of care that is provided for that reason.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Jeff Hayden, joined in the studio by tonight's co-host David Bigelizen. And tonight, we're discussing the legislative scheme that protects California seniors and dependent adults from a whole litany of abuse or neglect. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding on any question on tonight's topic. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. You're listening to Your Legal Rights. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. You're listening to KALW 91.7 here in San Francisco. And now we return to Your Legal Rights with your host, Jeff Hayden.
And right before we broke, we were talking a little bit about physical abuse and neglect, how we can recognize it, how we can watch out for it. let's talk a little bit about financial abuse. What is elder financial abuse?
Sure, Jeff. So under the Elder Abuse Act, financial abuse is defined as when a person takes, retains, or misappropriates the property of an elder or dependent adult with the goal of defrauding or wrongly using the property. But even if someone simply assists with the misappropriation of an elder's real or personal property, they could also be at fault. Deceiving older adults is not a new problem, but it is definitely one that has been growing in prevalence, and we've noticed that over the last 10 years in our practice. Actually, more than 1 out of 10 elderly people in the U.S. was a victim of elder financial fraud over the last year.
So there's one that we spoke about as we were preparing, one sort of fraud that's sort of a favorite of yours. Why don't you speak about that one first?
Sure. What's, I think, becoming the most prominent, the most common source of calls that we got, that we get in our office, and that our co-counsels had a family member who actually was a victim of this herself, is the scams that we hear about on the news. Scams, I'll give you a few examples. So a scam where an elder is told that they won the Publisher's Clearinghouse sweepstakes, but to get the money, they first have to send cash to pay for the taxes and fees. So the elder takes the money out of the bank, puts it in an envelope, and mails it to the scammers, never to be heard from again. Or a scam where a scammer calls over the phone, an elder picks up, asking for donations to support a school for underprivileged children in some part of the world. The elder wires money from the bank week after week to support this cause, and the cause itself doesn't exist. There's also common online dating scams where an elder will meet someone online and wire money to their newfound love, who says they want to move to the United States to be with that person. They repeatedly transfer and draw off of their life savings, and ultimately the person never comes. The romance is never fulfilled. We also have situations where a known perpetrator, like a caregiver or a purported sweetheart, milks the elder for all their worth, and the elder transfers money from their retirement accounts, then withdraws cash repeatedly to give to the scammer. We also see, and this is particularly scary, elders that get a pop-up message on the computer that an app is up for renewal. And once they click on that pop-up, the scammer can actually enter into the computer and remotely access all that person's passwords and data and accounts and change things over or withdraw funds or make transactions happen. And they can confuse the elder into thinking that money was accidentally put into their account and then need to be paid back. And so then the elder willingly makes those draws out of their account. These are just a few of the most common scams, and there are a lot. It's always evolving. We know, too, we had a client who got a phone call from someone, and this was probably 10 years ago, saying that his grandson was in Canada and he had been arrested and he needed money to be sent there to bail him out of jail. And he fell for it and called me. I had represented him in a different case, and he was very ashamed. But now it's getting even worse because with the upcome of AI, it's really easy if you have a snip of someone's voice to use AI to make it sound like someone's actual grandson is calling them to be bailed out of jail so that money can be sent. We see these cases a lot, and one of the challenges in these cases is that the scammers can often be really hard to track down. And so when you talk about making someone whole, that can be a hard thing to do if the person is overseas or offsite or impossible to track down. And so what we've had success doing is figuring out who were the other people that had a duty or responsibility to this person a financial or fiduciary duty that maybe should have seen and noticed and acted on some of these red flag repeat withdrawals and transactions and try to hold those people accountable for not doing more to stop it.
Tell us how you do that.
So what we've done in the past is if we can show, for example, that a financial institution, and I think most of the larger banks do, has a policy which gives specific alerts or triggers for unusual or suspicious transactions, but that policy is either never communicated to the tellers and the staff, or it's just really sort of a policy on paper that's not carried out, then we can try to take steps to see if we can hold the financial institution accountable. We see a lot of financial institutions that really do market and advertise how much they take steps to protect and secure the finances and the assets of senior citizens. But when we scratch below the surface, it seems like the steps are not really there. But we know, for example, anybody that's gone and bought gas in a random gas station out of your regular routine, you'll get a text or some kind of an alert from your credit card company saying, hey, did you really make this transaction? And so we know that the technology and the resources exist for those kind of flags to come up, say if someone is making repeat large draws on their money market account that they've had and sat stagnant for years while they built and maintained their life savings. And then when there are repeat draws off of it, nobody's making that trigger. Nobody's asking whether that transaction is authorized.
Can you change the settings on your account so that the bank knows if it's more than X number of dollars, they need to contact you or contact your designee?
You know, that's a good question, and I don't know the answer. My expectation would be that there is some way to do that. Although, you know, in the past couple of years, we've worked along with some other firms and organizations in California to strengthen the financial abuse protections and strengthen the requirements, for example, for banks to have to act or contact, for example, a trusted relative or something like that. But we have faced a pretty uphill battle, so those have not been put into law as of yet.
Let me take a call from Francisco. Francisco, you're on the air. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi, thank you for taking the call. I don't think this falls under abuse as much as negligence, but I have a caregiver for my mom, and she's great when she's there, very attentive and organized everything, but she takes vacations all the time, and when she leaves, it's like a parade of unknowns running through there, and they're nice people, but they don't know what the routine is as far as cleaning her up, making sure her meds are taken, et cetera, you know, when she eats, how much she's supposed to drink, et cetera, et cetera. And it's like she's, you know, gets really disoriented when, like, her primary and secondary caregiver is not there and it's some strange person that doesn't know what to do. So I'm wondering, you know, I'm not one to sue anybody or call the cops, or that's not me, but like, is there like some kind of letter that my attorney can send and say, hey, you know, you're taking money. This is senior care. Let's go. Let's be a little bit more attentive, or we're going to have to, you know, shake you down a little bit with the law.
So I think it probably depends on the exact specifics of your situation, kind of what the action would be and who it would be directed toward and coming from who. If the caregivers work for an agency, then that agency is certainly a point of contact that you or an attorney could reach out to discuss.
Yeah, she owns the agency.
Right.
She's the owner of the agency. So it's like, you know, it's the same thing, same entity.
Right. I think that finding consistent staffing for that type of agencies, I think that is a challenge. I think it's, and probably since before the COVID pandemic, it was a challenge. And then finding staffing for elder care has become more challenging, but it's certainly worth a discussion and putting the owner of the agency on notice of not just the problem, but also the outcomes you're seeing as a result of the problem.
Okay.
Would changing caregivers be indicated in such a situation?
Well, I think so, but like Francisco had mentioned, so in people that are elderly and especially people with some cognitive decline, those people really benefit a lot from routine and consistency
right.
in terms of their day-to-day actions, but also the faces that they see. And so it's really a delicate balance, and you have to kind of look at all the factors and weigh the pros and cons to make that decision.
That's what I'm thinking. Okay,
so
thank you.
It's a line, basically, or maybe a gray area is a better way to put it. Replacing that caregiver to get somebody in that's a little more reliable has some benefits, but on the other hand, it compounds the problem because now they've got a whole new cast of individuals.
That's certainly true, and that same problem is escalated, for example, too, if someone has some cognitive decline and lives in a facility, and if they're abruptly changed, not just in terms of their caregivers, but also their location and, you know, the organization and layout of their space and everything like that. The more pronounced the changes are, the bigger the potential impact can be on the elder. And so it's just really something that everybody would have to weigh on a case-by-case basis to make sure that you're looking at immediate safety, long-term safety, security, and your comfort level with the people that are providing the care.
Carmen, I'd like to move into a couple of other categories of financial abuse, and I'm thinking of caregivers, which we just spoke about a little bit, and relatives, and the things that they sometimes do to take financial advantage of elderly people. Why don't you tell us about that?
Sure. So I'll start with caregivers. So caregivers are often in a unique position where they can start by just providing sort of basic assistance around the house. And their duties as they get more trust can increase over time until they're the person that is taking the ATM card and going to the bank to withdraw money or writing out the checks or helping with the finances for someone who may have some cognitive impairment or, you know, vision loss or something like that. And so those people, you hope that your loved one is getting cared for by someone that they can really trust, but there are certainly bad actors who will, you know, write out a check to cash and cash it and keep the money or do something like that if they know especially that no one else is really watching. That's also fertile ground for taking valuable items from the home or potentially, you know, taking other steps. I haven't seen a lot of that more brazen, you know, trying to get a property moved into your name. But we have, you know, it is kind of known practice that people can try to get into someone's good graces or maybe get into someone's estate plan or inheritance, which is something to be on the lookout for. And I think that the estate planning rules, they've really tried to build in safeguards to prevent that. But, you know, it's certainly something I think the estate plan and generally people's plans around finances is something that should be discussed among the family early and often over the course of someone's care to make sure that probably more than one person is really watching.
A friend went through a difficult time with caregivers for a parent. One wrote a check that was pretty significant to themselves. A different one found all the family jewelry. And yet you have other family members, including the elder herself, who were insistent that nobody gets called, the police don't get notified.
That can be tricky, and that may be a time when some sort of civil remedy is considered. But, you know, if you don't have someone who's going to say that something wrong happened, I mean, you really need someone to, not just the check, but somebody to say, oh, yeah, I didn't authorize this. I mean, that's the best case scenario, because otherwise it's sort of a his word versus hers, which can be a hard case to try and win.
Sometimes it's hard for an honest lawyer to keep up with a thief.
That's true.
I'm thinking now a little bit about fiduciaries. And I'm going back many, many years when I worked on Wall Street, and our firm used to represent crooked stockbrokers. And they had a number of really fairly simple, boneheaded ways of stealing from little old ladies. Tell us what your experience is with that.
Sure. So, I mean, just like in the banking arena and just like scams, it's well known and well documented and studied that as we age, even if you're not carrying a dementia diagnosis, your cognitive ability to figure out if you're being tricked or scammed, that starts to decline over time. There are multiple studies on that. And so it's not surprising that financial institutions, investment brokerage houses, reverse mortgage lenders will try to come up with schemes which may sound like a good deal before you dig too much into it, and which are really marketed towards elders. The other thing that comes to my mind is like the solar contracts. We have in our neighborhood salespeople always coming around with these great deals to increase the value of your house by getting into this solar agreement where you basically pay a whole huge amount of money up front and you can never get out of it. And those things are, I think, generally targeted toward the elderly and don't often end up paying off. It can be challenging. Those type of cases can be challenging on an individual level. And so, you know, that's the type of thing where you might look at and consider whether if there are enough people who are similarly injured, there may be room for some kind of class representation.
There were cases that we had when we were on Wall Street where the little old lady whom I spoke of before had a lawyer who found out what was going on and would report the matter to the brokerage house. The brokerage house wanted this over and done with as little said as possible, and they would pay the claim off and fire the broker. Well, guess what? The broker would look for another job at another brokerage house.
Right, and I don't always think that the same records follow people around in that area as they do in other areas when people are accused of other kinds of abuse.
Okay, what else do we want to talk about in terms of financial abuse?
Well, I would say that there, like I said, reverse mortgages are something people should be cautious about. Any kind of thing where an elder is being sort of targeted and pressured to make a decision about an investment or a financial situation, those are the type of things that people should be talking about with their family members before they happen, so that when the elder is in that situation, they can think about who they'd feel safe going to. One of the things with financial abuse that we know from our experience is that when people start to get into these scams or into these bad deals, it can be embarrassing. It can be something that they don't necessarily want to talk to their kids about because they sort of feel like maybe they made a bad choice or maybe they made a bad decision or maybe just that it's their own decision and they don't really want anybody else in their business. And then suddenly they realize they're very much in over their heads. And so starting the conversation as broadly as you can about what to look for, who to talk to, where to go early, and having it often, I really think can help destigmatize that stuff. If you really figure out how many times, how many people in your circle have received those emails asking for someone to go and buy gift cards at the store and fallen for them? It's way more than anyone would think. And I think the more people realize that these scams are happening, that they're working, and it's not just you or it's not just your mom, the more people are going to be able to put in place plans to stop them or to act quickly to sort of stop the bleeding and stop the damage.
So let's talk a little bit about things that elders and their families can do to protect themselves and, with some hope, have fewer of these things come up.
Sure. So like I said, I think the biggest way that people can protect themselves is to start to think about these situations and come up with a plan to protect your health, a plan to have your sort of ideal living situation known, and a plan for somebody to be there to help you make decisions or make decisions for you in the event that you can't, early, before you're in a crisis situation, is essential. So designating a power of attorney, putting together a will, having a healthcare decision maker are all things that really every family should be talking about, you know, in their 40s, 50s, 60s. It shouldn't be when you're in the face of admitting someone to a facility or when you're dealing with a dementia diagnosis that you're making these decisions, because by then it's sort of too late to know what everybody really wants and for everyone to understand. And then I think just really being on the lookout for changes in seniors, in their attitude, in their demeanor, in their health, talking about those things, being proactive and advocating and being involved in their care, in their communities, and understanding and being on the lookout for scams are huge. Now, in the event that something actually happens, I would say if it's a physical abuse or neglect situation, you have sort of a decision tree depending on the severity. Like I said, if you really think that you've been the victim of a crime or that something is happening right now and your safety is at risk, I think there is the first option is to contact Adult Protective Services or contact the police. If you're in more of a long-term care situation where you just need an advocate, you can contact an ombudsman, ombudsperson. Most counties have a volunteer force of people that will help you and advocate for you in a facility.
We do have one last minute call, and one thing I've personally experienced with the ombudsman, they're very great at being admitted and getting in and seeing what's going on. They are the ultimate advocate for this person, at least learning what the senior wants. Let me take a call from Peter. You're on your legal rights. Welcome.
Okay. I'm glad I heard about this ombudsman because, well, here's my situation. When I was going on 20 years old, I went on a bicycle trip. I caught a virus and it blinded me. And suddenly they threw me out of the hospital. I said, go figure it out. They sent me home to my family. And now that I know, I've known enough blind people now, and they say family is the worst. So every time you say family, talking with your family, family is the worst. And I'm telling you, from my experience, money being stolen, the things that family can get away with. You know what I'm saying? And so you're saying ombudsman. No one said about an ombudsman. There are times when I've been in situations where I'm like, do I call 911? Who do I call? I need help. And I still don't know who to call. You understand what I mean? Because you're saying like elder abuse. A lot of the things you're talking about with the elderly, it touches on issues for me, but I don't have dementia. I'm clear thinking that it's that people get away with things because I'm blind. You know what I mean? They can steal money. They can use my credit card. They can run up $13,000 worth of debt. Why? Because it comes in the mail, that whatever, and they steal my mail before it gets to me.
Peter, I hate to cut you short, but we are running really tight on time. I'd like to give my guest a chance to give some suggestions to you before you go.
Oh, yeah.
Sure. So I would suggest, especially, so I'm it's unfortunate to hear about your situation, Peter, but I'd say if there's someone you can trust that can help you monitor your finances, I would reach out to them to sort of have a backup. Anything you see that is out of the ordinary or that you have a question about, I would contact the bank right away or the credit card provider. And then wherever you are in your community, there are a whole host of nonprofits and legal referral services that can provide you at least a stepping stone, a first step of someone to talk to get advice about the situation and where to go from there. And I would start with that.
Okay.
Peter, I wish we had more time, but I want to thank you for joining us once again.
Okay.
And I do want to turn it back to you, give you a minute or so for any last minute resources you want to advise people of, any last comments.
Sure. So I guess the big takeaway I really have is if you have a question, it's worth a conversation. And that can start with someone you trust in your own circle. But I think it's always worth contacting someone at a legal referral service. There's an organization in the Bay Area called CANR, California Advocates for Nursing Home Reform, that does a lot of work on both the long-term care and the financial abuse fronts, which is invaluable. There are legal referral services in, I think, almost every county. And then beyond that, there are lots of attorneys and advocates that specialize in these cases and really know this area, and they would be happy to talk to you whether or not your case ends up being a case that's filed in court.
Did you have anything you want to throw in for the last 15, 20 seconds, David?
Yes, and that is this program is sponsored by the Bar Association of San Francisco. The phone number for the lawyer referral service is 415-989-1616, 415-989-1616. If you have a question about elder abuse or any other kind of legal problem, they're there to help you.
And just to clarify, they underwrite this program, at least in part. You're listening to Your Legal Rights. Tonight we've been talking about elder abuse and protecting the not only California seniors but also dependent adults from both financial and physical abuse, courtesy of our friends at Stebner, Gertler, and Guadagni. Is tonight's guest, managing partner, Carmen Guadagni. Be sure to join Your Legal Rights again next week. It's a usual time of 6, where we're talking about uncertainty following our elections. One thing's for sure. As always, we will take your calls and answer your questions. A big thanks to tonight's guest, Carmen. I'm sorry, I'm having a terrible time tongue-tied this last 15 seconds. Carmen Guadagni, and a big thanks to you, all of you, for listening and for joining us. And for tonight's co-host, David Bigelizen, and at the controls, Marla Davies. I am a very tongue-tied Jeff Hayden. Thank you, be safe, and zealously guard your legal rights.